From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Joyce Vance.
Joyce, it's a new year. How are you feeling?
2022.
I'm back. I was gone for a little bit. I had the COVID.
That's right. You did. And did you end up being symptomatic or did you have an easy go?
About 2.5 days. You know, it's very funny. I didn't reveal I had COVID until I recovered. And then I tweeted about it. I thought it'd be helpful for people to understand that you can get it and recover from it, and urge people to get their shots and their boosters, because I think that's what protected me and two members of my family. My wife and my son also got COVID. But remember, we recorded the podcast in December. It was my third day of COVID, and I didn't say anything. And once I revealed on Twitter that I'd had COVID, a number of our very nice and loyal fans were like, "Yeah, you sounded terrible. I could tell something was wrong. That's what it was. Wow, you sounded awful." So thanks, listeners. Thanks for letting me know after the fact that I sounded awful and you suspected something was up. But it's pretty bad in New York. Every day I hear about a number of people who have COVID. A lot of people have it. But the ones who are vaccinated and boosted, generally, not in every case, but generally speaking, are doing quite well.
There seems to be this general malaise where people have given up and they think we're all doomed to get COVID. And I think that's not the case, right? I mean, down here, Alabama is starting to look like what happened in New York is going to happen to us as well. I think we just have to remember to be smart. And like you say, there is nothing like being vaccinated and boosted to keep COVID mild.
No, really, really, really important. New Year's came and went. Did you make any resolutions?
You know, I actually did make a resolution.
You did?
Normally don't. I'm not like a huge fan of resolutions. I'm not like I'm going to lose 30 pounds this year and run a marathon kind of person. But seriously, all joking aside, something that always troubles me is when we talk about democracy and the future of our country and talk about the need to get to work. And a lot of people will have the question of, well, what can I do? You know, I'm sitting in Iowa or in Birmingham, Alabama. What role can I play? And so one of my goals for this year is specifically when it comes to voting and to election rights, is to try to help connect people with opportunities to play a role, whatever role they're interested in playing and wherever they are, but to think about how we can all be more active participants in democracy.
Well, that's really great. That's a pretty good one.
I guess if you're going to have a New Year's resolution, that's the one, right?
I'm going to adopt that. I'm going to adopt yours as well, a little belatedly.
I hope you will.
I tweeted last week, so are we making resolutions this year or not? And the overwhelming consensus was to blow that off this year.
Yeah. Not going to clean my house, not going to cook healthy meals every night. Just, I think we're all out of energy and we should conserve what we have for the stuff that's really going to matter this year.
Well, that's a great segue, Joyce. What's really going to matter? We are recording this on Tuesday, January 4th. This Thursday is the one-year anniversary of the insurrection. And so obviously lots of people are talking about lots of things. It is being remembered in a particular way in the Congress. There will be speeches and ceremonies, and people will be looking back and we'll be seeing the footage again. So, you know, we have our own perspective on these things. So I thought we would start not with the nitty-gritty, but sort of big picture. And you and I have been texting back and forth over the last few days about, you know, really what one of the ultimate questions is. It's not the only question, but among the questions that I think is at the forefront is, anyone going to be held accountable beyond the individuals who stormed the Capitol? In other words, people who are of higher rank, who are involved in organizing it, up to and including the president of the United States at the time, Donald Trump, and his main advisors. I think we're up to like 727 people charged with some kind of violation of law in connection with January 6th, but nothing beyond that. How do you think about that question before you even answer it?
You know, all different kinds of thoughts, right? But I think you're right that this is the starting place. The real question for the time we live in is whether or not the former president is going to ever be held accountable. Because if he isn't, this whole notion that we're a rule of law country where no one is above the law, that sort of goes out the window. I'm going to hedge my bets on that answer a little bit by saying this. I think it's a moral imperative that there be investigation. when it comes to prosecution, there are complicated questions involving admissible evidence and being able to prove all of the technical legal elements that go into an individual crime. But at least when we're talking about investigation, which is some measure of accountability on its own, it seems to me that there has to be, there is, and the only question that's left is whether it'll be DOJ or somebody else.
Well, there's a prior question. You know, we talk about this as if there has not been an attempt to hold Donald Trump accountable, and we can be forgiven for forgetting because it sort of went and fizzled. But on this particular question, perhaps the most appropriate place for accountability to have been gotten was in the Congress itself, in the House and in the Senate, because after all, what was the insurrection? It was an attack on the Congress, and they had an ability and they had a mechanism for dealing with it in an extraordinary fashion, right? In the final days of a presidency, impeaching for the second time a sitting president, and then having a trial in the Senate after he left office, and that failed. So what do you say to people who might suggest, look, there is a mechanism for this, and it more properly belonged in Congress rather than an assistant district attorney in Fulton County looking at something happening in Georgia? And that process, whether you like it or not, resulted in an acquittal, a resounding acquittal of the former president. Shouldn't that be the end of the story?
Of course, that was always the political process and strictly a political sort of sanction. It's an interesting question. You're right that it was a resounding loss. It also happened very rapidly because time was running out and there was that feeling that it had to happen or at least had to be in process while Trump was still in office. But, you know, something that the impeachment process really highlights is the difficulty of developing evidence of what wasn't just an incident on January 6th. There was the whole lead up, the perpetuation of the big lie that ultimately resulted in the events on January 6th when nothing else had worked for Trump. Putting together the evidence that you need to make a compelling case is difficult. And the congressional investigators were doing that in the face of massive obstruction, witnesses who didn't show up. It seems like every day in the course of the last year, we've heard new evidence, new information, and we've said, wow, it would have been really great if Congress had had access to that during impeachment. You know, would it have changed the votes of senators whose minds were solidly made up? Maybe not. But I think if you want to make the argument that there should be a criminal or a quasi-criminal process or at least a House investigation post-impeachment, then it's because so much new information has come to light that wasn't available then.
I have two reactions to what you said, and I agree with one of them. My reaction over the last number of weeks and recent months is astonishment at how much new information has come out. And even though it's been, you know, 363 days, almost a year, it's startling to me how much we keep learning. You know, just in the last day or two, I guess there have been reports that Ivanka Trump, the then president's daughter, on more than one occasion during the actual unfolding of the insurrection, said to her father, you know, you got to do something to make the violence stop. And you make the point that it would have been nice to have this information for the impeachment proceeding, but I agree with your suggestion that it wouldn't have made any difference at all. Might it have made a difference with a couple of people's votes? Maybe. Would it have made a difference in public perception? Maybe. But it continues to amaze me how much more we're finding out. I mean, just remember, we found out many months after this, some of the pressure calls made by folks in the White House to Jeff Rosen. We found out about, you know, that former head of the Civil Division, Jeffrey Clark. None of that was known at the time that the impeachment proceedings were taking place. And that's a shame, I think.
I think that's right. And again, you know, maybe this is obvious, but for people who are concerned about the pacing of proceedings, people who feel like Trump should have been indicted 30 days out from January 6th. Public corruption cases, and I sort of consider this in that vein, they take a really long time. When you're looking at developing a case on what have you, senators, members of Congress, county commissioners, those cases for a local U.S. attorney, they can actually take years to build. And the reason is that the evidence just doesn't present itself on your front doorstep neatly wrapped up in a ribbon. It takes time to uncover it, time to make sure that you're understanding what went on and what the crimes actually looked like or whether crimes were committed at all. Sometimes what looks like a crime can be conduct that's lawful but awful. And so it's important to respect that. But at the same time, there's this looming question of whether DOJ really intends to get on with anything other than the people that stormed the Capitol here.
Yeah. So I want to come back to that question in a moment. You know, part of the fault lies with the federal government itself. I remember at the time, no one was really arrested on, I don't recall that anybody was arrested on January 6th, right?
They all walked away.
They walked away. They took flights home. They drove home. And then by a painstaking methodology of looking at photographs and social media and following leads, these people were all then arrested back, mostly in their hometowns. So that wasn't great. The second thing that I think continues to be astonishing, and it gets to your question about what DOJ is doing, is to this day, unless I'm forgetting something, there has not been an address to the country by either an attorney general or the FBI director in the way you would have after some other kind of incident, like, you know, the bombing of the Marathon in Boston a few years ago, or some other major nationally significant event. And this is a hugely important national significant event. No one ever talked to anyone. You had that weird press conference by the then U.S. attorney in D.C., for which I think he got in trouble, and then he went on 60 Minutes. But it's weird that you haven't had that. And the reason I mention it, and maybe I'm forgetting some addressing of it, but I don't think I am.
You're not.
You're just kind of waiting for someone at the top of law enforcement, the FBI director, the attorney general come to mind, and they haven't done it. Now we hear that Merrick Garland, the current attorney general, is going to be giving a speech to the staff at DOJ to address the issue of accountability for the events of January 6th that will be broadcast to the public. I think it's a little late. It's a little late.
Just a little.
I respect A.G. Garland very much. The other thing I think that's happening, and you framed this at the outset of this conversation, is what is DOJ doing? And a lot of people, I'm not sure where I come out on this, a lot of people seem to be frustrated that it doesn't look like DOJ, from their perspective, is taking a hard look and investigating people at the top, like Mark Meadows and Donald Trump and others. And in fact, Adam Schiff, who everyone knows, said on the Stay Tuned podcast just a few weeks ago that he's disturbed by what looks like a complete absence of a high-level investigation of that sort. And we will get again to the distinction that you mentioned between investigating and prosecuting. The way I think about that is Merrick Garland is an old-fashioned, old-school prosecutor's prosecutor and has been a judge for a long time. And he doesn't like to say much. And that's, you know, one of the principles of how you go about doing the job, violated sometimes by Jim Comey with respect to Hillary Clinton. Got him in a lot of trouble. But he is probably facing, tell me what you think of this. He's probably facing the following dilemma of, on the one hand, not wanting to raise expectations and talk too much about what, if anything, they're doing to investigate the possibility of charging, in the way that you and Barb discussed a couple of weeks ago, high-level people with particular statutory violations, you know, not wanting to raise expectations there, and at the same time, wanting people to understand that they're doing their job and being aggressive. And I wonder if that's sort of stymieing him and that's what's causing people to wonder what's going on. Does that make any sense?
You know, it does. He's in a really tough place. It's sort of a damned if you do and damned if you don't. So I think that there are some governing principles that could be used here. And one, frankly, is having a little bit of confidence in the American people. Trusting Americans to be adults, not pandering to the worst elements of our country, the elements that he might have some fear would be activated if he made certain statements, and just trusting the country with a little bit of transparency. And by transparency, I don't mean coming out and making a statement about who he's investigating and for what crimes, if he's in fact investigating. You know, there's a bright line for me tomorrow in what Merrick Garland might say to the troops at DOJ. If he talks in very limited terms about investigating the violence of January 6th and the large number of prosecutions they've done, well, that's one thing. What I need to hear him say is that DOJ will follow the evidence no matter where it leads, and that no man is above the law. And it's the reaffirmation of that principle.
What about women? What about women, Joyce?
Women, too. I mean,
we're going to get to that later. The two women convicted of crimes.
We do have women involved, right? But you know what I'm saying. I mean, joking aside, it would do a lot of good for the country to hear the attorney general say that without fear or favor, he'll follow the evidence wherever it leads, even into the Oval Office. And I think he needs to specifically say that.
But doesn't that raise expectations? Doesn't that cause people to say,
yeah,
oh, well, now since it's taken him so long to say something like this, he's going to be worried. This is all speculation. He's going to be worried that is finally... I know what's going to happen. You'll be called to be on MSNBC. I'll be called to be on CNN. And we'll be asked the question, what does this mean? After a year of silence on this, he's now talking about the Oval Office, if he uses the language that you're suggesting. That must signal that they have the goods, right? And he doesn't want that.
He can't engage in any sort of conversation about the details of what's going on. I think he's got to talk about process. And you're right, it does raise expectations. But if you're so afraid of your own shadow that you can't say, we will continue to operate as DOJ always has, following the evidence wherever it goes, you know, that seems to me to be a little bit too concerned about what goes on in the public. The problem, though, you've pointed out, is that this is a long overdue speech. And if following January 6th, somebody, the attorney general, the director of the FBI, had stood up and said this, and if there had been, you know, some sort of ongoing briefings, look, ongoing briefings, it's common in major events. You know, we had the bombing of an abortion clinic in Birmingham, and there were round-the-clock briefings immediately and then briefings over time following.
Everyone is afraid of their own shadow. In the final 2 weeks of the Trump administration, I think we have some basis for understanding why maybe Jeffrey Rosen at the time wanted to keep his mouth shut, because what we didn't know back then was that he had been pushed and pressured to do all sorts of unsavory things in the service of overturning the election. So maybe he didn't want to go to the podium back then. Then you have...
talking about evidence it would have been nice for Congress to have during impeachment.
Particularly given his involvement and the possibility that he would be a witness to some of these things. And then you had a transition. Then the new guy comes, and the new guy arguably is not going to come and talk about it because he wasn't there at the time. He's still being briefed on it. And there becomes no good time to do or say anything. Here's the other thing working against Merrick Garland and causes confusion in the public, which I understand. And that is, he's not the only figure, right? You have a state attorney general in New York, Letitia James, who was relatively not quiet, right? Who says... in the campaign and says as attorney general, makes strong statements about how they're going after Donald Trump, how they're investigating Donald Trump, how no person is above the law, says all these things that I would never expect the U.S. attorney general to say. But in the eyes and ears and minds of the public, I'm sure some people are wondering, and maybe listeners can chime in on this in an email, why can't Merrick Garland do what Letitia James is doing and just say, yeah, you know what? I don't know if there'll ultimately be a prosecution. James doesn't say that either. But we're looking as high as we can, and there is evidence that merits an investigation that goes as high as the President of the United States that relates to, you know, particular statutes like obstructing an election, obstructing Congress.
Okay, I'm getting a little bit queasy while you're saying all of that. That goes a little bit too far for me for a sitting attorney general, right?
I agree. I'm saying that the public is confused because they see a state attorney general doing it. What's the difference? So I think it puts Merrick Garland in a bit of a bind because there are other people who are kind of mouthy about this.
So I think that that's fair, but I don't think it gets him off the hook. I think it means it's past time to acknowledge that there should have been more transparency with the public, not inappropriate transparency. But I think DOJ can always do a better job of talking with the American public about how it works and why it does things, even if that's to explain why it conducts its investigations in secret. The better educated the public is, then the less problem you have when there's a difficult situation like this one. And so I think what Garland has now, and it's interesting to me that he's chosen a webcast to DOJ employees to do this, but I hope that what happens tomorrow is more than just a recap of the press release where he says, Nationwide, our offices have been involved in an investigation into the violence that took place on January 6th. I hope he will reaffirm, without going into detail, DOJ's commitment to doing the right thing. And I think it would be even appropriate for him to talk a little bit about the special role that DOJ plays in law enforcement in this country. You know, it's always been true that public corruption matters have been relegated to DOJ for prosecution, in large part because it's difficult for a state government to prosecute its own officials when they've engaged in corruption. Garland now has that sort of a problem, right? It's tough for the federal government when we're talking about federal officials because there's all this appearance, whether it exists or not, of political influence. He's going to have to navigate that path and explain to folks what's going on and what's fair game and what isn't. But I'm not sure that's what we're going to hear tomorrow.
So there seem to be two camps. You know, there are friends of ours who are very notably frustrated about what seems to be the lack of an investigation. Adam Schiff is among that group. And then there are others, and I've seen their social media posts and I've seen their commentary, who say, look, any criminal act that involves lots of people, you start at the bottom and you build your case slowly and you go up. And I understand that point as a general matter. But here, when you have hundreds of people who stormed the Capitol, and you're saying that, you know, flipping them is going to get you the president of the United States, which is an argument they seem to be making, this is not that. This is not a well-organized, hierarchical, organized crime family syndicate, right? Where, you know, you go with the one guy, and then he gets you a guy one level up, and you keep moving up in that way. Do you agree with that, or do you think there's something about some of these charges with respect to the Oath Keepers, perhaps, that will allow prosecutors to get a window into higher level folks?
I think that that's a possibility with some of the Oath Keepers type cases. And there are some interesting situations where there is this conversation, allegedly, about bringing guns into the District of Columbia on January 6th. Of course, guns are illegal there. There's been reporting that there are witnesses who talk about ferrying guns across the water. That implies a certain level of organization that would be interesting to pursue to see where it might lead. And of course, we've also seen this reporting about war rooms and the Willard and people who were involved in maybe different capacities and different war rooms. Whether that all connects and whether that ultimately funnels higher up, I think, is an interesting inquiry that's more analogous to this typical sort of rolling up the chain investigation that prosecutors are used to conducting.
Yeah, I think that may be. I think what's more important than flipping people who, you know, busted into the Capitol, who engaged in more or less violence, depending on the circumstances of that particular person, is the stuff that happened around Donald Trump on January 6th itself. Obviously, there's other evidence about the big lie, and it all, you know, fits together into a narrative and a story and a compelling, I think, using in the non-specialized way, indictment of the former president. But we keep hearing more and more things about the supposed 187 minutes. Someone said we shouldn't use minutes because it doesn't sound as long as 3 hours. 3 hours and 7 minutes from when the insurrection began and Donald Trump made a statement. I mentioned a few moments ago that, among other things, Ivanka Trump told him he should do something about it. There's evidence and reporting that many people told him to tell his people to knock it off. And Liz Cheney, who was on the 1-6 committee, Republican, but increasingly being marginalized in her own party, has said, essentially, if you're watching television during an insurrection on the Capitol, you're unfit for office. And the state of mind of the former president is incredibly important here. We're not going to have emails from him. We're going to need to understand from the people around him, including Mark Meadows, including Jim Jordan, including his daughter, including, you know, everyone who had any communication with him at all on January 6th, what was his reaction when the violence began? And that speaks volumes, doesn't it?
I think it does. And I think you're honing in on just the right way of looking at that. I have heard people speculating that the former president's failure to act could somehow substantiate criminal charges. And I'm always very leery of this notion that inaction leads to criminal consequences. There are some statutes that are written that way. Sometimes there are regulatory actions. I agree with you. I think that what's important here is using that inaction as proof of his state of mind.
Yes, 100%.
Right. And that could support other types of charges, maybe a conspiracy to interfere with government or some sort of interference with official proceeding charges. It's his state of mind that's so critical here.
The way the argument would work is you have evidence that he wanted the obstruction to take place. He wanted the interruption to take place. He gives that speech. He talks about fighting. He has all this other conduct leading up to January 6th. So that's, you know, your primary argument, that he wanted it to happen, that he directed these people and incited them to violence at the Capitol. And what's your proof of that, as you point out? Well, some of your proof of that is when it actually happened, he seemed to be happy about it, which is consistent with his original state of mind as given by the principal argument, right? If it wasn't what he wanted, you would expect a president to be mortified and to call folks into action immediately and to call them off. He was none of those things. He had to be basically pressured into making a statement during which he also said how much he loved them.
That was a really good closing argument.
All right, so maybe Merrick Garland should announce the indictment of Donald Trump tomorrow.
Can we back up a little bit and just read some tea leaves? Because I don't see a lot of signs that DOJ is looking at this. And I would expect that even in a closely held investigation, some grand jury witness someplace would say that they had a subpoena.
That's precisely what Adam Schiff has been saying, that there doesn't seem to be any clue of that, and that's a problem.
But I do see a little bit of other stuff. There seems to be some indication that DOJ might be looking at some of the money, like Sidney Powell and her little shady funding. You know, it's not clear that they're looking at other stuff, but it is possible that there's something going on out there.
So what about the January 6th committee? Should we assess them a little bit?
We should. I think that they're doing a great job.
And why is that?
I think that they have learned the lessons of other failed congressional investigations into Trump and come in with a plan for dealing with obstructive witnesses. That's one. Two is, I think that they've worked fast. They give every appearance that they worked through the holidays while Congress was in recess. It looks like the committee went on working on witnesses and gathering evidence. And although they're dealing with some delays, notably the Trump delay, the delay in turning over documents from National Archives that they've now asked the Supreme Court to act on in their conference, I think it's on January 14th, but it's they've asked the court, rather than putting it onto their calendar for the year and slowballing it, to deal with the issue promptly. The committee has come up with five lines of investigation. They've put experienced prosecutors and investigators to work. And so they're tracking down, you know, they're following the money. They're looking at what level of organization there was around January 6th events and who was involved. And I think it may be a little bit embarrassing ultimately for DOJ if DOJ is not investigating. And if at some point Congress, you know, hands over to them these neatly organized blue jacket files full of potential charges and evidence. But Congress is looking an awful lot like a U.S. attorney's office right now.
Well, be careful how you say that, because arguably that plays into the argument of the Trump defense, which is this doesn't really have a legislative purpose. They're trying to be an investigative or prosecutorial body, and that's not appropriate. So do you want to rephrase?
Yeah, I don't really want to rephrase, because I think that you can be serving a legitimate legislative purpose, and there are a number of them here for Congress. And before you can deal with your legislative goals, you need to engage in a full investigation into what took place leading up to and on January 6th. And you also need to understand whether crimes were or were not committed in this regard, because something that Congress could legitimately do here, in addition to protecting against future sorts of incursions like this, in terms of strengthening the procedures for certifying the vote, Congress might want to consider whether they need to tweak existing criminal laws or create new criminal penalties. So I think, frankly, this is an argument that the Trump folks have been pushing very aggressively, and it could take on a little bit firmer of a response from the congressional committee advocates.
Can I ask you a more particular question further to what you were saying before about what appears to be the lack of activity investigating folks at the top?
Sure.
If you were the attorney general or the U.S. attorney responsible for figuring out what happened on January 6th, would you have long before now had FBI agents interview or attempt to interview Ivanka Trump and Mark Meadows and Mike Pence and their respective chiefs of staff and other folks who were in communication with each other and with Donald Trump on January 6th?
So my answer is it depends. And what it depends on is how much I know and whether they're purely witnesses or whether they're subjects slash targets. If I already know pretty much everything that went on, let's just say I'm the committee and I've had a lot of information from people who were there and I think I know what went on, I'm probably ready to interview those people and make a final decision about whether they're going to be witnesses or targets.
I agree with that. And I would also make the argument that, let's use a different hypothetical, you don't know everything. And we're back in, you know, February or March of 2021. And there were reports of things, and you're trying to understand what was the state of mind of the people at the White House. Did they want this incitement to happen or did they not? You want to question all the relevant people who have some insight into that question. And whether or not you or I or others would have done that, going to your further observation and conclusion, clearly that hasn't happened because we would know, wouldn't we? We would know if the FBI tried to interview some of those folks in connection with the DOJ investigation as opposed to the 1-6 committee.
Yeah, I mean, you know, given the way this crew operates, there would have been outrage in the press, right? And I mean, you know, that's an interesting
So is that
point.
A huge failing, Joyce?
Well, I'm struggling with that a little bit. My inclination in a case like this would have been to talk not to Ivanka Trump, but to talk to the people who had the opportunity to observe her and to see what was going on. And I just don't think I would have wanted to talk to her, and I'm just using her as an example for all these other people, until I really felt like I knew what was going on for this reason. If I'm going to have potential for her to be a witness, I need to know that. And if by the same token she's going to lie and there's going to be some prospect of 1,001 charges for lying to the government, then I need to know where the pressure points are and make sure she's asked the right questions. So I'm not sure that I consider it a failing. I think it would be a failing if they weren't approaching folks around, folks that they could get a picture from. And I do wonder, you know, for instance, what has happened with Bill Barr, who's been off the radar? Did they talk to Bill Barr? Did they talk to Jeff Rosen? We just don't know. And it's sort of frustrating that we don't know.
So lots of this investigation with DOJ, obviously, we don't know what's going on beneath the surface, but it looks like there's less than some people would like. On the 1-6 committee, we're hearing reports and people are fighting about things, so we're hearing about some of that. But they're going to enter a new phase, and it's a very important one for purposes of public confidence and public understanding and transparency. And they think they did it the right way. In the couple of investigations I was involved with, when I was in Congress, we did it this way. You have behind closed doors depositions that are very detailed for hours and hours and hours and collection of documents. And then you put on a very carefully organized, cynics might say choreographed, but carefully organized set of public hearings that sort of hit the highlights, where probably not a lot of new revelatory things come out, but it's an explanation, not in a newspaper with anonymous sources, but actual witnesses live under oath on television on every cable network, or I guess at least on most cable networks, and maybe even, you know, regular broadcast networks, talking about all this stuff that they have learned. How do you think that's going to go?
You know, I think it needs to happen, and it may not be revelatory to us or our listeners, but to people who are just out there living their lives and trying to keep food on their table, who haven't had the luxury of following these events as closely, those sort of hearings can do something really important. They can perhaps bring together, you know, whatever percent of the country hasn't totally gone off the rails here, and give folks a shared set of facts. And then we can argue about what those facts mean, right? But at least we have a common understanding of what happened on and around January 6th that helps us move forward as a country.
Yeah, I think that'll be interesting to watch. And it will be interesting to see how folks spin it. So there's another area we should touch on this. And another thing happened since we were last together, and that is the new year came. But one significant inflection point of the new year is that there's a new district attorney in Manhattan. As some listeners may know, I endorsed him and supported him. He used to work for me when I was U.S. attorney, Alvin Bragg. I had predicted many, many months ago that given all the signals we were getting, it's sort of the opposite of Merrick Garland, right? I feel like Cy Vance, and maybe this was not intentional and couldn't be helped, but there were some signs and clues that they believed they had the goods on Donald Trump. They hired an outside forensic examiner. They hired Mark Pomeranz, formerly of the U.S. Attorney's Office, to work on the case, convening of grand juries. All those things seemed to indicate that they were in full throttle and they thought they would be able to bring some kind of criminal case. I had expected that that would be something that would be determined either a charge or a declination, you know, a closing of the case before Cy Vance left office. It didn't happen. So I was wrong about that. Important for people to recognize is, even though a charge wasn't brought, the case wasn't closed. Cy Vance, in a sort of an exit interview with the press, with the New York Times in particular, said, I know what we did. I know why we did it. And at the end of the day, that's what I have to live with. Basically saying they did what they were supposed to do. And now the case is being handed off to Alvin Bragg. What do you read into any of that?
Well, I think it's a recognition that these cases are complicated. You know, like you, I had actually thought that Cy Vance would make a decision before he left office. Can I just say on a personal note how glad I am that I'm no longer going to have to deal with people who want to know if I'm married to the Manhattan District Attorney? I mean, super happy about that. But, you know, these cases take a while. Vance was met with heavy opposition. He had to litigate the tax cases to get Trump's taxes for an ungodly amount of time. We don't know if this is a holdup or if this is a recognition that maybe there's some failure in the evidence, but Bragg has signaled that he wants to retain Cy Vance's team on this investigation. We aren't seeing people pack up shop and leave the district attorney's office. So I think that that means that whether or not they ultimately charge, the case is still in play.
And here's the other thing that happened over the summer. There was some difference of opinion among the legal punditry. Remember, over the summer, there was a charge against Weisselberg, the former CFO, and a couple of Trump organizations. I thought that was not very significant. And I thought that indicated that they didn't have much because Weisselberg wasn't persuaded to flip before he was charged and certainly hasn't flipped since, and those charges related to, you know, tax issues involving fringe benefits, nothing in the heartland of what we expected they were looking at with respect to Donald Trump himself or other people in the Trump organization. And then there was another camp that thought, wow, that signaled just the beginning of, you know, lots and lots of bazookas that were going to be fired against the Trump organization and the Trump family. I remain in the first camp.
I think that's right. It was a swing and a miss, an effort to get Weisselberg to cooperate, and now he, you know, will maybe pay some price for that failure. More recently, though, there's been indication that the focus of the investigation has shifted to people outside of the Trump organization, that they've been interviewing accountants and folks at Deutsche Bank. And I saw an interesting article earlier this week in The Insider that talked about the Trump-owned property at 40 Wall Street in Manhattan. And, you know, there's been speculation that this is what's being investigated, but this actually suggested that the Trump organization had told lenders in 2012 that the building was worth $527 million. And then a few months later, they told tax officials that it was worth just $16.7 million. If that's the focus of this investigation, if it's more than just the accuracy of Trump organization officials when they were seeking financing, but this reflective comparison of seeking financing versus paying taxes, that could be very fruitful down the road with or without Weisselberg in the mix.
So there was some other news. I mentioned Tish James already, the Attorney General of the state of New York, in connection with a civil investigation. Subpoenas apparently have been issued to, among other folks, Ivanka Trump, the former president's daughter, and also Donald Trump Jr. And those folks, true to form, in Trumpian fashion, have said, we're not going to comply, which is interesting to me because this is not a congressional subpoena. This is a garden variety, everyday, civil investigative subpoena that you cannot declare executive privilege over because the matters that are being investigated don't relate to the presidency, don't relate to the president or the office. They relate to business matters. By the way, we should tell folks who are amateur lawyers who are listening and hear people on television talk about a motion to squash the subpoena. I keep hearing people say squash the subpoena. They're moving to squash the subpoena. And that actually makes sort of linguistic sense, right? You want to squash the subpoena. That's not the word. So if you ever take a, you know, a trivia test on legal terms, the word is quash. There's no S. It's quash the subpoena. Am I right? Do you pronounce that differently?
No, we say quash, but I do sort of like squash better. And I sort of
I keep hearing people say that. I think very, very bright reporters and journalists, they see it come across the computer and they think it's a typo. Because what the hell does quash mean? And so they add the S. It is not squash. Maybe that should be the title of the episode. It is not squash.
It's not squash.
It's not squash.
And there will be no squashing here, right? In some shape or form, Don Jr. and Ivanka, who, if my memory is correct, their last sort of outing with the New York AG was a falling out over the Trump Charitable
Fund,
which was closed. And I think that they were ordered to take ethics training. I don't know if they ever did that or not. But I think ultimately they all sit for these depositions, as uncomfortable as that may be.
Yeah, I mean, what sometimes happens is, and it's not uncommon, that a request for information is conveyed, the subpoena is served, and someone asks for 100 things, and the party that gets the subpoena says that's too much, it's overbroad, it's burdensome, whatever the case may be. They go to the judge, and the judge says, yeah, you know, some of these are overbroad. You can have 89 things, not the 100 things. But that's not quashing the subpoena. That's narrowing the terms of the subpoena.
And it's interesting in the context of these proceedings that the court sort of kept its jurisdiction open. In the pleadings, there's this recognition that there was an expectation that there might be ongoing efforts to fight off these subpoenas. And so the court retained jurisdiction so that it could continue to hear these matters rather than requiring the New York Attorney General to come back with separate proceedings every time somebody tried to squash.
Oh, I see what you did there. I saw that. I heard that. So I chided you a few minutes ago, Joyce, because you said something about no man is above the law. And this week in particular, there were two prominent women who were found to be not above the law. You have Elizabeth Holmes in that highly watched trial on the West Coast in connection with her blood testing company, Theranos. And then here in the East Coast, in my very own Southern District of New York, Ghislaine Maxwell was convicted of child trafficking charges. Neither was convicted on all counts. It was mixed. With respect to Elizabeth Holmes, she was convicted on some, acquitted on some, and on some they couldn't reach agreement. So there was a mistrial as to those counts. We spent a lot of time talking about 1-6, so we can't go into detail about those trials. Surprise? No surprise? What's your reaction to those?
Confirmation that the jury process works and that if you put 12 Americans into a room, they can sort out the facts, understand the law, and get things right. The appellate lawyer in me is really delighted to see these verdicts are split verdicts, right?
Explain what you mean by that, because prosecutors say that all the time. I'm not sure lay people understand why.
So on appeal, the most frequently argued issue on appeal is something called sufficiency of the evidence, where the defendant asks the appellate court to reverse their evidence because there wasn't enough proof against them. It's a very difficult argument for a defendant to make out, in large part because appellate courts look at the verdict of the trial court with great deference, and they'll reverse only if no reasonable jury could have convicted. But, you know, that said, when you have a jury that carefully considers different counts in a complicated situation and returns a verdict on some and not others, it gives force to the argument that prosecutors will make on appeal that the jury applied the evidence correctly. So appellate lawyers always have to
And was very reasonable.
Split.
Yeah. It's like, look, this is a jury that knew how to acquit, and they did on some counts. What I thought was interesting about Holmes is, remember, there were two sets of victims that were alleged in that case. One set of victims was the investors, right, who prosecutors alleged had been defrauded based on misrepresentations and false statements and fraud and everything else. And the other set of victims were the patients. And the jury didn't find that the patients had been defrauded. Those are the counts on which there was not conviction, but did find that the investors were defrauded. So further to your point, you can argue, and they will argue on appeal, that it was a sophisticated jury that rejected some of the arguments by the prosecutors and accepted others. And so you can impute reasonableness to that jury.
I think that's right. And I think at least those sorts of sufficiency of the evidence challenges will fail on appeal. I expect both of these defendants will mount appeals. There's been some suggestion in both cases that now that they've been convicted, they'll cooperate to try to get a better sentencing result. I think rather than that being the case, both of these matters now move on to appeals.
Well, that's interesting. Let me ask you a final question. You know, the Theranos case is not over. Elizabeth Holmes has been convicted. She'll appeal, but her case was severed. Her trial was severed from her former boyfriend and colleague at Theranos, Sonny Balwani. Who's Elizabeth Holmes going to cooperate against? Would you flip her against him? I don't think so.
I've seen so many people suggesting that, and absolutely not. She's
no way.
Clearly the kingpin here.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to flip her against a littler fish.
And on Maxwell, wow. I mean, there's so much baggage there. She's a very, very unattractive witness in terms of what her conduct was, what she was convicted
still
of.
Still facing perjury charges in a separate case.
You know what we managed to do, Joyce?
What?
We managed to go an entire episode without talking about abortion.
You know, Preet, that's a first.
But we will be returning to it because our views on what's going to happen to reproductive rights remain, I think, pessimistic. At least mine are.
I think that's right. And more action from the Supreme Court in the coming year. This week, they'll be taking up the vaccine mandate issue. So we'll be back to court watching next week.
So folks, keep sending us your questions. We're back next week. Send them to letters@cafe.com.
We look forward to answering them.
That's it for this week. Cafe Insider is presented by Cafe Studios and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Joyce Vance. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The senior producers are Adam Waller and Matthew Billy. And the Cafe team is David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Namita Shah. Our music is by Andrew Doss. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.